President Biden and Speaker McCarthy have reached a bipartisan debt deal. That's what the headlines say. Of course, there is no deal until they sell this package to wary House members on both sides of the aisle. Then on to the Senate, where it's likely not to be such a cliffhanger. All the usual suspects will be stepping up to the microphone to say in no uncertain terms why they oppose this deal. However, the real negotiations take place in the back rooms and hallways as deals and promises are made in exchange for votes. No one likes to know how sausage is made, but this is how Washington has worked for close to 247 years. Welcome to The Money Runner. I'm David Nelson. The price tag, a whopping $4 trillion increase in the debt limit. The debt deal raises the current $31.4 trillion debt ceiling for 2 years, taking it well beyond next year's election, maybe a blessing for both parties. It didn't take long for House conservatives and progressives to announce that they aren't at all pleased with what Biden and McCarthy are calling a bipartisan deal. Sorting through the real concerns and the political spin is job number one for investors this week. Sound bites from both sides are just too many for me to cover, so I'll just mention a few of the more notable comments. Senator Ted Cruz panned Speaker McCarthy, obviously incensed over the $4 trillion ceiling raise. Progressive Caucus Chair Representative Pramila Jayapal on CNN's State of the Union told host Jake Tapper she's not happy with some of the things she's heard in the bill. She also had a message for the administration that they still have to worry about progressives supporting this legislation. Representative Matt Rosendale, Republican of Montana, made a statement Sunday night saying he'd vote against the bill. Adding $4 trillion to the existing $31 trillion in national debt is an insult to the American people, he said. The Nonpartisan Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget described it as the first major deficit-reducing budget agreement in almost a dozen years. The noise in Washington over the next several days as we approach what is now a June 5th drop-dead date will be deafening. While the legislation solves an immediate need to keep the country solvent, it's a short-term fix to a long-term problem. Any rational view on what it's going to take to solve our fiscal and monetary problems has got to include an end to a business-as-usual mindset. Real leaders are willing to explore new options to rebuild institutions that have become rotten with decay and inefficiency. In some cases, that may mean starting from scratch. Sometimes, a system like a house is so far gone, Band-Aids just aren't going to hold it together. I get it. The issues are complex, but the inputs to the problem are no different than what most Americans deal with each and every day. Revenue. What is my income? Is it enough? What can I do to increase it? Expenses. How much am I spending? Am I spending more than I earn? And can I get goods and services I need at a cheaper price? It isn't rocket science, people. For this week, let's start off with a conversation on revenue. Taxation. Every government needs a source of income. Taxes continue to be a principal form of revenue for most civilized societies. The U.S. has a progressive system where those at the bottom of the income ladder pay less as a percentage than those at the top. Been that way since Lincoln. So how is that working? Some think it's working great. In fact, so great, they want to double down on it. They believe that if we keep raising the marginal tax rates higher, we should have more revenue for services to the American people. To me, that's kind of like a retailer saying, if I raise prices, I'll increase my income. A conversation with a gas station owner or someone sitting behind the cash register at any retail store will set the record straight pretty quickly. as anyone in business understands, there are limits, and that higher rates do not necessarily translate into more federal revenues. Some, like venture capitalist David Sachs of the All In podcast, point to federal tax revenues as a percentage of GDP as proof positive that the system is flawed. There does seem to be a wall as to how much revenue can be generated regardless of the marginal rate. Look at that chart. 1930 to today includes periods like the late 50s and early 60s with top tax brackets well above 90%. However, federal tax revenue as a percentage of GDP never exceeds 20%. I think this is an excellent start, but it's just the tip of the iceberg. The current tax code is about 77,000 pages, and you can bet much of that code is dedicated to carve-outs and exemptions. The only real winners in a system this complex are the lawyers and accountants the wealthy hire to structure their finances to pay reduced taxes. It's pretty clear that if you believe the United States needs to move to a balanced budget, or at a minimum, keeping the federal deficit from ballooning larger, the heavy lifting is going to have to come on the expense side of the ledger. Having said that, just like the debt ceiling talks had low-hanging fruit like unspent COVID relief funds, so does any rational discussion on how to restructure the tax code. For most of the last century, capital and/or investments have enjoyed preferential tax treatment. Helps explain the statement by Warren Buffett, "I pay a lower tax rate than my secretary." The intent was to encourage capital investment, which would translate into increased economic activity and, of course, more jobs. 100 years ago, in the early stages of the Industrial Revolution, maybe that made sense. Unfortunately, today, the unintended consequences outweigh the benefits. Today, the capital base is massive and to a large degree sits mostly in the hands of those at the top of the food chain. Why should a hedge fund, private equity, or real estate investor be taxed any differently than someone working on an assembly line at Ford or Boeing? The answer is, of course, they shouldn't. No one is suggesting that by eliminating the preferential treatment of capital gains, that you're going to magically solve income inequality, and I'm certain that shouldn't be the goal. There will always be a gap between the successful entrepreneur who's putting capital at risk and the on-the-line employee. But the playing field should at least be level, and today the current tax code is inherently unfair. It wasn't always that way. Before the tax acts of 1921, capital and income were taxed the same. There have been countless permutations and adjustments through the years, but today, more than ever, it seems time to trash the current system and eliminate the preferential treatment investors get over their working brothers and sisters. If you work at a business and receive a salary, you're taxed at the graduated income brackets to capture your salary base. However, the owner of the business might take very little in ordinary income, paying relatively lower taxes, letting his or her wealth accumulate in the business. When the business is potentially sold in the private market or shares for public companies, the cap gains rate is often used. Even if the cap gains rate is raised to 28%, it may not be the same as if it were ordinary income. The only real hurdle is that the asset was held for more than a year. Again, I'm not advocating for higher cap gains rate and certainly not higher income taxes, but level the playing field. Income is income. I said earlier, the expense side of the ledger was going to have to do much of the heavy lifting. There's nothing heavier than a U.S. defense budget, which is now proposed to be $886 billion for fiscal 2024. Given that every corner of the planet is a geopolitical hotspot and one of our largest trading partners, China, is increasingly a military threat, the U.S. is going to need the most advanced weapons on the planet. That means defense spending and lots of it. This, of course, demands an answer to the question. Are we getting our money's worth? Given the Department of Defense has failed a GAO audit 5 times, I think it's a question most of us would like answered. That's a quick preview of my coming podcast on defense spending. As always, we hope you'll become subscribers and become part of the Money Runner family. Here's something new. If you'd like to appear on our next pod, go to our website, themoneyrunner.us. You'll be able to record a video question that will appear on our next available podcast. Thanks for joining. I'm David Nelson.